Now, I'm going to the dimension part of it briefly. Didn't intend to do this, but time is not going to permit me to do anything else this evening. Apologetics, the authentication of two kinds of revelation, is the title of the general introduction. And I deal with the logical importance of two kinds of revelation. Then the historical background, which I show that it's been an important aspect of the history of apologetics. And then I give you the biblical basis for two kinds of revelation. And I turn to Psalm 19 and Romans 1. Now, since I think most of you will accept that premise of two kinds of revelation, I feel safe and consigning it to your reading and to the quiz for next time. All right? Okay. Now, section 1 is the defense or authentication, then, of natural revelations. Well, that's my preferred term for general revelation. Natural revelations, declaration of the existence of God, on page 107. Page 107. Now, many passages might be brought to bear on the subject of how we know that God exists through natural or general revelation. There are three passages, however, which are of special importance. Probably the chief, most comprehensive, and most foundational of these three passages is Romans 1, 18 through 23, and I want you to turn there in your Bibles, please. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 23. And if I had only one passage I could expound in this class, it would be this one. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Now, in the same general section of this book is Romans 2, 12a, 14, I can expound that as Roman numeral 2 of section 1. And then these two passages in Romans give us Paul's doctrine or theory of how we know God exists. In the last passage we will notice how Paul practically applied this theory in his ministry. And here we will study Acts 17, verses 16 through 34. Tremendous light on how men know of the existence of God, or what we might call theological epistemology, will be given to us by our study of these passages. So we come then to Romans 1:18 to 23, and by way of introduction, I want to say a few things about its context. Now, this study of the context of Romans 1:18 to 23 will also be relevant for Romans 2:12a, 14, and 15. First of all, I want to give you a simple overview of the different views of the relevant context. It's generally recognized that Romans 1:18 to 3:20 is the backdrop for Paul's treatment of the revelation of the righteousness of God in the gospel. The theme of Romans 1:18 to 3:20 is the revelation of the wrath of God. Hence the opening verse, "The wrath of God is revealed." Different views are entertained by expositors, however, on the precise development of Paul's thought in this section of Romans. Note that this overview deals only with 1:18 to 3:8, as 3:9 through 20 is less relevant for our purposes and not a matter of so much debate, because it seems to be, on everybody's estimation, a kind of conclusion dealing with both Jews and Gentiles, and they're all being brought together, and the whole world being brought together under the wrath of God. So I'm dealing with 1:18 to 3:8 because 3:9 through 20 is not a subject of so much debate. First, I want to deal with the view of Hodge and many others, or the common view. Hodge basically says that 1:18 to 32 deals with the Gentiles, and 2:1 through 3:8 deals with the Jews. And in the view of Bruce and many others, what I might call the moralist view, and Lenski has a modified version of this, 1:18 to 32 is said to be the Gentiles, 2:1 through 16 to be the moralist, and 2:17 through 3:8 to be the Jews. So there we have three different types of people, Gentiles, moralists, and Jews. The view of Cranfield, what we might call the concentric view, and Lenski's version is also a modified version of this. This is that in 1:18 to 32, we deal with men in general, and 2:1 through 3:8, we deal with Jews in particular. Then there's the view of Waldron and Nichols. Not to be too awfully proud about the thing. I see I put Greg with me there because I need some support. When you go up against Hodge and Lenski and Denzel and stuff, people like that, you know. Anyway, the view of Waldron and Nichols, the modified concentric view. This is a variation of views B and C. In it, we assert that 1:18 to 2:16 deals with men in general, and then 2:17 to 3:8 deals with Jews in particular. And the importance of that is that it makes both 1:18 to 23 and 2:12 to 15 fall within Paul's dealing with men in general rather than with the moralists or Jews in particular. Now, here is an illustration then of the modified concentric view, where you have the larger circle being men in general. And that's 1:18 all the way through 2:16. And then the smaller circle being the Jews, and that is 2:17 to 3:8. All right? Now, I want to give you, having laid out the different views and an overview of them, several considerations supporting the proper viewpoint. I guess you can't guess which one that is. Anyway, according to my view of the passage, the entirety of 1:18 to 2:16 is concerned with all men in general. The following arguments support this view. First of all, 1:16 speaks of Jews and Greeks. I'm not ashamed of the power of the gospel. It's the power of God to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And then there is no narrowing of the scope in verse 18 where those considered are called men, i.e. men in general. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Of men. Greek word anthropos in the plural genitive anthropon. Important thing, as we'll see in a second. So, we begin with no narrowing of the scope. The Jews and Greeks of verse 16 are the men of verse 18. Then 1:18 to 32 is not concerned with Gentiles only. And this is why I would prefer to speak of it in terms of men in general. Men generically, if you will. Verse 23, in fact, where they are said to exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures, alludes to Psalm 106:20 and Jeremiah 2:11, both of which speak directly of Jews, not just of Gentiles, although, of course, Gentiles and their idolatry, which the Jews were at that time practicing, were also guilty of it. 3. There is nothing, and this is an important point, to indicate a change of scope in chapter 2, verse 1. The language is universal. Every man of you who passes judgment, the language is also consequential, having to do with the results of something already said. Therefore, you are without excuse, connects this with the foregoing. The language of passing judgment, while appropriate to Jews, is also applicable to Gentiles because in chapter 2, verse 15, it speaks of how the Jews, the Gentiles, pardon me, who do not have the law, have consciences which alternately accuse or defend them. And so the language of passing judgment, well, of course, it's particularly applicable, as we know, to the Jews. It's also applicable to Gentiles, so no argument for an exclusively Jewish reference is capable from that premise. 4. Both Jews and Greeks are considered in the body of 2:1 through 16. And you can consider especially, I'm not going to read the passage, 2:6 through 15, where Paul alternates from Greeks to Jews to Greeks and deals with every man being liable to the judgment of God. How inappropriate, then, to put these verses in a passage which is supposed to be dealing with Jews only. And then fifthly, note the occurrence of the term men, anthropos. Interestingly, both in 1:18, the unrighteousness of men, and then in 2:16, on the day that God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. Its occurrence, I assert, brackets the section and shows that in its entirety, this passage, 1:18 to 2:16, deals with men, that is to say, men in general. But sixthly, the transition or shift to Paul's treatment of Jews in particular, is clearly marked. Note verse 17. But if you bear the name Jew, throughout 1:18 all the way to 3:8, this is the only clear transition or shift in the scope of thought or reference visible in the entire passage. And so I would assert that that is where we should make the breaking off point. So for all of those reasons, I believe that the modified concentric viewpoint is the correct one, and that, therefore, both 1:18 to 23 and 2:12 to 15 occur in a section of Romans dealing with men in general and not Jews in particular. Therefore, dealing with men as they are by nature and not as that special kind of man that was the subject of divine scriptural revelation. But now, there are several conclusions, then, from the proper viewpoint. I've already anticipated one or two of them. 1:18 to 2:16 is dealing with the wrath of God on men in general. We may therefore expect from this passage to learn about the light which men have by nature. The light which men have by nature. And that's important, of course, to our task. We may expect to learn about the light, the violation of which exposes them, men in general, to God's wrath. As a matter of fact, both 1:18 to 23 and 2:12a, 14, and 15 are intended to justify the justice of God's wrath by showing the knowledge men have of God outside the circle of special revelation. We are not taking these passages out of context, then, when we ask about how men know by nature the existence of God. They are precisely intended to answer the question, do men know God? They address themselves to the nature and origin of men's knowledge of God outside special revelation. Of course, do that for the particular point of justifying God's wrath against such men. And then I've already noted that it's interesting that the two classic passages occur at the beginning and end of this section, 1:18b to 23 at the very beginning, 2:12a to 14 and 15, penultimate towards the end. And then thirdly, some have thought that 2:12a 14 and 15 is speaking of regenerate Gentiles when it speaks of those who do instinctively the things of the law. In verse 14, they thought that that was dealing with regenerate Gentiles. Now, that is a serious misinterpretation of the text. The context shows that these verses cannot be speaking of saved Gentiles. When they speak of those who do by nature the things of the law and have the work of the law written in their hearts, they're speaking of those who have only the light of nature and who therefore cannot be saved. And I'll go to say some more about that in the future. But assuming at this point that those who have only the light of nature cannot be saved, this passage is speaking of those who have only the light of nature and therefore of Gentiles and not regenerate Gentiles. So those are the conclusions I would draw from the dealings with the context. Any questions at this point? Okay, theme. As has been said, our passage falls in the section dealing with the wrath of God on all men in general. And this raises an obvious question which Paul proceeds to answer in the opening verses of this section. How is it just for men to be punished who didn't have the law? Paul is saying the wrath of God is revealed against men, not just Jews. Well, Paul, how is it just for God's wrath to be upon men who didn't have the law? What is the basis of God's wrath? Not just on the Jews who have the written law, but on all men in general. What about all those men who didn't have any knowledge of God? you might add. The theme, therefore, of verses 18 to 23 is the justice of God's wrath against men. Paul refers to this theme when he says that God's wrath is just because it is revealed against truth suppressors, who suppress, he says at the end of verse 18, the truth in unrighteousness. Men, all men, are truth suppressors in their internal form, as Paul's answer to the questions we've raised. The word translated suppress, katekonton, may mean either to hold fast or to hold down the truth. The meaning hold fast is found in 1 Corinthians 7:30 and 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Hold fast that which is good, speaking of genuine prophecy. But it cannot, of course, be the meaning here. Men cannot hold fast the truth in unrighteousness. That's nonsense. Rather, they hold down, they suppress, they repress the truth in unrighteousness. And two significant passages here where that meaning occurs with reference to kateko are 2 Thessalonians 2:6 and 7, Earl, and Luke 4:42, Patrick. 2 Thessalonians 2:6 and 7, Luke 4:42. As soon as you have it, Earl, read it. Oh, well, we'll pardon you this time. Go ahead.
And now you know what is holding him back, so that he may be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of lawlessness is already at work, but the one who now holds him back will continue to do so until he is getting out of the way.
Okay, the key verb is hold back, translated by the New American Standard, restrain, suppress, repress, hold down. And then Luke 4 and verse 42.
And when day came, he departed and went to a lonely place, and the multitudes were searching for him, and came to him and tried to keep him from going away from them.
Tried to keep him from going away, hold him down, hold him back, suppress him, repress him from going away. Now, that's the theme, then, of Romans 1:18 to 23, the wrath of God against men in general, its justice, its propriety, its basis. But now the structure of it. The entire passage flows out of verse 18b that ends with the words, of course, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Both verse 19 and again verse 21 begin with the conjunction dot, and that word can be translated because. Verse 18b is then the thematic statement. Men are truth suppressors. Verse 19, because they have the truth. And then verse 21, because they suppress the truth. There's the flow of thought. Men are truth suppressors. They are truth suppressors, first of all, because they have truth to suppress. But of course, that doesn't make them truth suppressors. They are truth suppressors because having the truth, they suppress the truth. And that's the point of verses 21 through 23. So these facts about the passage provide us with our outline. And it's a very interesting outline in light of some of the things we've seen in our history of apologetics. A, as men have the truth, or we might subtitle it, their knowledge of God, verses 19 and 20. B, is that men suppress the truth, that is to say, their ignorance of God. So in this one passage, we have what? We have a clear distinction between two kinds of knowledge of God, just on the surface of it. They have knowledge of God, they don't have knowledge of God. They know God, they don't know God. Paul asserts them both in the space of six verses. Very interesting. Well, we come then, first of all, to answer some of the questions about this passage, to the first section, men have the truth, or their knowledge of God, verses 19 and 20. We read there, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. In verses 19 and 20, Paul reveals seven things about the knowledge all men in general have of God. He deals, first of all, with its reality in verse 19a. He says, that which is known about God is evident within them. Now, two things in this clause assert the reality of their knowledge of God. There wasn't such an emphasis, you might almost think that Paul was being redundant, but he's emphasizing it to the point of redundancy. First, Paul mentions that which is known about God. Now, in some translations, this clause is translated that which may be known about God. The question is the meaning of to gnoston. And that is, as I go on to say, the NIV translates it, what which may be known. The word in the original, however, may mean either what is known or to what may be known. Now, in the other 14 occurrences in the New Testament, it always means, I say dogmatically, it always means what is known. This makes it certain that its meaning here is that which is known about God, is known. Thus, Paul begins by asserting that men do know God. These truth suppressors do really possess a certain knowledge of God. It says that which is known about God. Now you say, well, why do some people translate it may be known? Well, that's the usage that's more common in secular Greek, especially in, I believe it's classical Greek of the previous centuries. But now, secondly, Paul goes on to say that what is known about God by these truth suppressors is evident in them. Now, Paul is not satisfied to say, as the NIV translates, that this knowledge of God is evident to them. Paul does not use the dative or the preposition meaning to. He uses the preposition en. He uses the Greek preposition meaning in, and it is evident in them, is what he says. That which is known about God is evident in them. That's what makes Sproul say, emphatically, the knowledge gets through. Because that's exactly what Paul is saying. It's evident not just to them. It's evident in them. Now, it is possible, of course, to translate this preposition with the word among sometimes. So it might be translated among them. But in does not mean among here with the majority of the commentators that I've checked, it means in. It would be very unnatural and awkward to say that creation or general revelation, even if we assume that that's what Paul is talking about, is among men. No, the point is that the knowledge of God supplied to men is evident in them. It gets through. It's not simply outside of them and they're blind to it. In some real sense, it gets through to them. It's in them. The point is that this knowledge men have of God is neither distant nor obscure. It is revelation of the divine glory in them. God has made the kind of revelation which actually does make something manifest in men, in their hearts and in their minds. Men are not totally oblivious to or unaware of God's revelation. God's revelation results in men really knowing Him. That's Paul's point of emphasis. It's evident in them. That's the reality of it. But then we come to its author. Because, or for, God made it evident to them. You have to see the emphasis that Paul's putting on this here. We can kind of pass by it. That which is known about God is evident in them, for God made it evident to them. These words teach that it is none other than God Himself who is the ultimate source of the knowledge Paul has been discussing. The point is that men may not excuse their deeds by claiming that the knowledge they possess is faulty. No, God, in all the fullness of His power, wisdom, and goodness, is the author of their knowledge. It is not, therefore, faulty in any way. God is not like a poor bugler whose notes are too confused or soft to rouse the soldiers for battle. No, there's nothing wrong with the bugler. God made it evident to them. But then we have its duration emphasized. Its duration. For since the creation of the world, I believe that it is the duration or their knowledge or of their knowledge or possession of the truth which is stated in those words, since the creation of the world. Now it may be translated from the creation of the world, and there is therefore some discussion of the proper translation interpretation of this phrase. One, is Paul saying that men's knowledge of God is derived from creation? Is it from the creation of the world? Or is Paul saying that men's knowledge of God has been available from the world's creation on? Is that the NIV translation? From the world's creation on? No. I must have gotten that from someplace else. Now, that's the choice. Is it talking about the source of their knowledge or the duration of their knowledge? Is it since the creation of the world or from the world's creation? Now, though both are true, Paul's point in this phrase is stated in the second of these choices. It's from the world's creation on. It's duration that he's emphasizing. Later in the verse, he tells us the means or source of the knowledge of God, and he speaks through the things that have been made. So at that point, he comes to deal with the source or origin of their knowledge or its means. But here, he's emphasizing how long men have had this knowledge. It's from the world's creation on. Rather, from the world's creation on, men have had the truth. The access men have had to the truth has been neither rare nor uncommon. No, it has been their continuous possession from the world's creation on. It's not like a student who was not able to buy the textbook for a course till the week before the exam and it completed, well, I didn't have the textbook that long. The student might plead that as an excuse. Men, however, have their textbook on the existence and character of God from the world's creation on. But now, fourthly, it's means or source. The means or source of the truth men have about God is displayed in the word through what has been made. The means or source of their knowledge of God was implied in the previous statement because the reason they had it from the world's creation on is that it is through creation that God gave it. But now Paul comes to explicitly state that. Man knows God through God's works of creation. Psalm 19, with its emphasis on the duration, source, and clarity of this creation revelation of God's glory, is a parallel passage. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows us handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, night unto night shows knowledge. And so Psalm 19 was probably in Paul's mind when he wrote these words. That's the means or source of their knowledge. But then it's clarity. It's clarity. Paul proceeds to emphasize the clarity of their knowledge of God in the words, have been clearly seen, being understood. Now, throughout the passage, Paul emphasizes the crystal-like clarity of God's revelation to men. Twice he has used the word evident in verse 19. That word may be translated plain, clear, or manifest. In verse 20, he reiterates this by saying that God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood. The verb translated, are clearly seen, is intensive. Its root means to see, but a preposition is added, which intensifies the meaning of see. Orao is the verb, which means by itself, to see. And then the preposition kata is added, so it becomes ka-orao. And, of course, that means to see down, or to really see. The emphasis, the prefix is intended to give it. The verb translated, therefore, are clearly seen. Is intensive. Its root means to see, but a preposition is added which intensifies the meaning. God's glory is really and clearly seen by men. There's a kind of paradox in the language. Paul literally says that God's invisible, orata, are visible, ka, orao. You see the same root? God's invisibles are clearly visible, Paul says. In these two verbs, then, Paul affirms that God's revelation is not only clear, but that it is understood. It's understood, he says. Clearly seen, being understood. It's understood by men. But sixthly, he deals with its content. Content. Verse 20b speaks of his eternal power and divine nature. Now, this is the most important description of the content of the knowledge which all men in general have of God, which we have here in verses 19 and 20. His eternal power and divine nature. Now, many commentators agree that while the first part of this phrase, eternal power, is a specific reference to one attribute of God, divine nature is a general reference to what John Murray calls the sum of the invisible perfections of God. Paul singles out God's eternal power for mention. Now, the emphasis on this is increased by the use of the modifier or adjective eternal. Now, why is there such emphasis on this attribute? Why does he single out eternal power as the specific attribute to be mentioned? Well, the reason seems to be this to me. If men know God's eternal power, they knew nothing else about God. Mere self-interest should have made them fear him. Man's failure to fear God, the God that they know most of all is a God of eternal power, is therefore inexcusable. Though men do not fear God, yet they do have a deep innate awareness of God's power and of their vulnerability before that power. And therefore their sin becomes a species of the most stupid arrogance and pompousness. This deep awareness provides us and our preaching, I'll say more about this later, with a point of contact in men. They know God's eternal power. Doesn't matter how they boast, how ungodly they are. It doesn't matter if they're a prostitute or a homosexual. It doesn't matter what they are. They know God's eternal power. God has made it evident to them. And there is something in their hearts that tells them of their vulnerability before God. We don't need to teach them that. It's there already. It may be appealed to as a point of contact with men. No matter what they say or how they act or what their theories or philosophies or religions are, they have a knowledge of God's eternal power. They have that in common with us, and we may appeal to it. This deep awareness of God's eternal power provides us and our preaching with a point of contact in men. But now here's what seems to be a point of emphasis to Paul. Men's knowledge of God is not limited to eternal power. The not only but even construction, or what in Greek is known as the tekai construction, seems to indicate that this is the really surprising or striking thing about the content of men's knowledge of God. They know not only God's eternal power, we might have expected that. We might have expected that they would know something of the greatness, majesty, exaltation, fearfulness, dread of God's omnipotence. We might have expected that they would know something about that. And know that he was eternal. We might have expected they'd know something about that. That we're not surprised about. But Paul goes on to say, not only his eternal power, but even his divine nature. Paul is asserting that the knowledge of men even includes the divine nature. In other words, it is more extensive than often is realized. Their knowledge is not limited to one attribute, the kind of amoral attribute of eternal power. Their knowledge is not limited to that. It is the entire divine nature with which they are confronted. Specifically, this knowledge includes not only the power of God, but also as part of the divine nature, the things I list, the goodness, wisdom, justice of God, and also themselves as the offspring of God. You notice the footnote here. I'm asking myself where the footnote, yeah, there's, it's at the top of the page. The word used here is theotes. Notice the yoda in it, different than theotes. and have a little different meaning. See the difference? No Yoda. Thaotase emphasizes deity. In him dwelt all the fullness of God bodily. Colossians 2:9 emphasizes the deity, the specific godness of Jesus Christ. Whereas theotes is a word that we might more closely approximate to the English word divinity. It's what is God-like. It's not so much godness as God-likeness. So when you have this applied to God, we're not talking just about his specific deity, but of what all that which makes him God-like. There's an emphasis on the breadth of his nature, of who he is, and therefore on his different attributes. Not only his eternal power, but, we might translate, his entire divine nature. Who he is as God, what he is. This is what God has revealed. Now, we may exegete, and this is what I'm about to do, exegete what is meant by divine nature here in terms of the rest of the Scriptures. What is this divine nature of which men are aware? Well, it includes a knowledge of many things about God, and the Scriptures make this very abundantly plain. And I want to just work through the things I have on this page with your help. First of all, to know the divine nature of God means that men know something, a great deal, in fact, about the goodness of God. The goodness of God. Now, unless I termed it, the goodness of God. I think it would be a mistake to equate that in this context directly without qualification with the grace of God, but I am able to assert without qualification that they know the goodness of God. Bob Gonzalez, Acts 14:17. Helm, I don't see you with the Bible there, so I'll get to Mike. Romans 1:21, Mike. And Steve, Romans 2:4. I want you to notice these three passages which speak of the knowledge men have of the goodness of God, and that by nature, not by Scripture. Acts 14:17 and begin with verse 11, Bob. Just blow right through it. You don't have to worry about it. Connect real quick. Yeah, that's right. Just blow through it.
God has become like men and has come to help to us. And they began calling Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowd. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their robes and rushed out into the crowd, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you, and preach the gospel to you in order that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways. And yet, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rain from heaven and fruitful season, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness."
All right. Now, clearly here we have to do with people that are in a state of nature without biblical revelation, so that any knowledge attributed to them is not due to the Bible. These are clearly pagans we're talking about here. And in verse 17, we have the word for revelation. He did not leave himself without witness. And then we have, when Paul tells us what the content of that witness was, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. There was a revelation in God's dealings with these people outside of covenant revelation, outside of the covenant, outside of the Scriptures. There was a revelation of God's goodness, of God's, what we would call, common grace. And significance that you have mention of the rain that in Matthew 5 is associated with God's common grace. That he loves, that there's a love of God expressed in nature towards all men. There's a goodness of God expressed He did not leave himself without witness. What was the content of that witness? He did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. What kind of God did that speak of? A God who was good. Good even to ungrateful and unthankful men. There's a God of common grace. There's the goodness of God. But now notice that this emphasis is implied very directly in our very passage, Romans 1, 21a.
Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God, or give thanks.
Yeah, there's the point. They didn't give thanks. Now, giving thanks is something we do in response to what? A display of goodness and kindness. That's what thanks is associated with. They didn't give thanks. Therefore, they knew something, the goodness of God, that they should have given thanks for. In Romans 2:4. Now again, this is where our treatment of the context is important, because what Paul says in this verse is applicable not just to people who have special revelation, but to men in general. Romans 2:4.
For do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and forbearance, and says he's not knowing that the kindness of God leads you to repentance?
All right. You see, there is in revelation, the revelation made to all men in general, in natural revelation, a display of God's kindness, forbearance, patience, and common grace that's displayed, and a common grace that ought to have had men the moral ability to respond to it rightly, lead them to repentance. It's a tremendous statement of the goodness of God. But they not only know the goodness of God, they know the wisdom of God. Paul, Proverbs 3:19. Mick, Psalm 104:24. And then Earl, Psalm 139:13 and following. Now, here we're going to do something that we talked about the other night, or who asked the question, but we were making the statement that when men are converted, they see what they should have seen all along in creation. So that when a converted man says, this is what I behold in creation, we know from that converted man's lips, especially as inspired in the scriptures, that it was really there all along, and that unconverted men should have seen it, and it was revealed there. Only it wasn't seen until men's eyes were open. Well, look at Proverbs 3:19, and you can see something of this.
The Lord by wisdom founded the earth, by understanding he established the heavens.
Isn't simply something that he knows because God revealed in the scriptures. Notice Psalm 104:24.
O Lord, how many years I have worked, in wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy
presence. All right, here again, it's obvious that this knowledge of God's wisdom is derived from an observation of what he's done in the earth and his works in the earth. And then Psalm 139:13 and following states this even more specifically and directly. Oh, yeah, through verse 16, I think is sufficient.
When you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in a secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body.
All right. So again, in these verses, it's plain that in creation, a tremendous display of the wisdom of God is given. But not only is the goodness and wisdom of God part of the content of the divine nature known by men, but so also is the justice of God. Now, this is implied in our very text. The wrath of God is revealed. Now, the wrath, the revelation of the wrath of God, of course, includes a revelation of his justice. But then notice Romans 1:32. Romans 1:32 is an emphatic statement of a revelation of the justice of God, not now to Jews, not now to people who have the Bible, but to those of whom Paul has been speaking in the preceding verses, Gentiles, men in a state of nature. And he says, although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. says they know the ordinance of God that those who do such things are worthy of death. That's a knowledge of divine justice attributed to men in a state of nature, the very men that God has reprobated and given up in the preceding verses. And then notice as well Romans 2:14 and 15. Again, speaking of Gentiles without the law, we read, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are the law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them." Included in all of that that Paul attributes to them there is clearly a revelation in some sense of the justice of God in and through their own consciences. But now what's so interesting, and what we must never fail to remember, is that men know this God, but they do not know him in the abstract. They do not know him at a distance. They know him at the same time knowing themselves to be the offspring of God. And I want you to look at Acts 17 here. Acts 17. Here, of course, is a passage we'll expound in a future lecture. Paul is speaking again to pagans with no knowledge of the Bible, or at least none that they would admit, no acceptance of the Bible, and yet he says to them, verse 28, "For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his offspring. Being then the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man." Now here, Paul says that your own poets have taught you that we are also his offspring. Now that's an amazingly interesting and in some respects difficult thing that Paul does here. He quotes a heathen poet approvingly. And if you examine the original context of that quotation, it becomes even more amazing. It raises even more interesting questions. But the point is, Paul quotes approvingly a heathen poet who said, "For we also are his offspring." Apparently, the heathen poet knew without the Bible that he was the offspring of God. So you see, what Paul is asserting here is that men know God in his eternal power, not only in his eternal power, but in his moral attributes of wisdom, justice, goodness. And they know all of that not in the abstract, not as some interesting content of knowledge that they have no personal relationship to, but they know all of that from the posture of being one who is the offspring of God, accountable to him. This knowledge, therefore, is not abstract, you see. Men as the offspring of God know themselves to stand in immediate practical relation to the God with whom they have to do, the God they know as eternal, mighty, good, wise, and holy. They have a certain awareness of this demand, of the demand of this revelation, of fear from them, thanks from them, worship from them, repentance from them. You see, they know the living God. They don't know simply that some God or other exists. They know the living God. They don't know just about his eternal power. They know his eternal power, his wisdom, justice, and goodness. And we might add to the list, of course. But you see, that's the point we're making here. There is a knowledge of the living God. Now, on the next page gives a graph of that content. There is eternal power and divine nature, wisdom, goodness, justice, and all of that known by one who knows himself to be the offspring of God. Now, I'll give you a chance for questions if you have any in just a second. But then we must come with Paul to his conclusion. That is the result of their knowledge. The result of their knowledge. Paul says, in the final words of verse 20, "so that they are without excuse." All that Paul has said, and especially what he has said about the extensive content of their knowledge, comes together to justify and emphasize this conclusion, without excuse. Literally, Paul says, they are without an apologetic or defense. Paul uses the same root as is found in 1 Peter 3:15. These Gentiles, because of this revelation, have no defense for themselves, no defense for their conduct. It's the result of their knowledge. Well, that is how Paul expounds the assertion that men have the truth. That's how he expounds their knowledge of God. Do you have any questions? Yes, Bob? They're aware of the creator-creature distinction. The chain of being concept was innately, inherently apostate. It was a sin against natural revelation to think that way. Not just the creator-creature distinction. That could sound abstract, you're right, but there's a relationship implied there, an accountability, what Paul describes, or what the writer to the Hebrews describes, pardon me, as the God with whom we have to do in Hebrews 4. That's the point. See, and you see all of this, again, emphasizing that in that knowledge given, granted to them in natural revelation, all of that we have in common. We must never view people, no matter how they look and how they talk, as somehow coming from Mars or a different planet in terms of who they are and what they are. No, they are this kind of person. They're the kind of person that has all of this in common with us. It doesn't matter who they are, where they come from, what they've experienced, how evil they are, how wicked they are, all of that remains true of them because it remains true of them because all of them are without excuse, and they're all without excuse because of what they know, in the language of Paul. What they know. Well, Bob, go ahead. Well, I think so, definitely. Definitely. I'm not sure we have to be scrupulous about making all those qualifications at least evident. The fact is that the world bears in it, the world is obviously, notwithstanding what an atheist says about, the world is obviously contingent and dependent. It's obviously not its own source, and it's obviously not eternal. It is a different kind of thing, and they know it. So we can certainly argue from cause to effect. And of course, to the necessity of having that cause for the world, for them to have any kind of reason for existence. Of course, they act all the time like they have a reason for existence. But they don't have, unless they presuppose the existence of the living God, they don't have any basis for that assumption, that premise of their life. They act as if they've got a reason for living. They think as if they've got a reason for living. They act and think as if there's such a thing as purpose and goal and rationality and reason for life, but they don't have any basis for that without a world caused by God. Okay, let's come to D then, because I want to finish this exegesis tonight. And there's some very important things to deal with here. Well, having dealt with the first DOT, because they have the truth, they are truth suppressors, we must now come to the point. They have the truth, and they are truth suppressors because having that truth, they suppress it. And so Paul, having dealt with their knowledge of God, comes to deal with their ignorance of God. And of course, he states that they had knowledge of God. Notice the beginning of verse 21. For even though, here uses the common word for knowledge, they knew God. Even though Calvin and others may have been scrupulous about applying the term knowledge to anything less than a true and proper religious knowledge of God, Paul isn't scrupulous about it. He says they knew God. They knew God. Now, let's come to that. That's the starting point of their truth suppression or their ignorance of God in verse 21a. He says they knew God. The starting point of the progression is found in the first phrase, they knew God. In this phrase, Paul confirms our interpretation of verses 19 and 20. We've been assuming this whole time that what Paul is saying in verses 19 and 20 is that men know God. And Paul confirms it. He says, even though they knew God, pointing back to verses 19 and 20. As a result of divine revelation, men not only could know God, important distinction, they not only could know God, they did know God. But an important objection must be answered here. In both the NIV and the New American Standard, the verb used here is translated in the past tense, for even though they knew God. Someone might ask, doesn't this indicate that men no longer know God? On verses 21 through 23, speaking of only a past generation, someone might think, surely long ago at the beginning, maybe just after the flood or just after the Garden of Eden, surely then knew God, but not today. How can you say that these men around us today in the Roman Empire knew God or know God? You can't say that. You may remember that this was exactly Kuyper's understanding of these verses. He applied it to a past generation. Others also have held this view. But this view leads to radically different practical conclusions about the meaning of this passage and the nature of biblical apologetics. And therefore, we must respond to it. And my response to this interpretation is that this is emphatically not what Paul is saying. It's misguided in the extreme to adopt that interpretation. And several important thoughts will show the misguided character of this view. First, the aorist tense used here, an aorist participle, the aorist tense used here, especially in participles, does not always indicate past action. It may indicate the idea of a logical starting point of a process. Lenski describes this process when he says, the idea that Paul here describes the historical origin of paganism misunderstands his purpose. In spite of the fact that they knew at that very time, they did not let this knowledge control or even check them. Two, the fact that men still know God today, present tense, is evident in several respects from the context. Both the preceding and the succeeding context point to this. Verse 21 is tied to the preceding verses by the connective because. Now, it's likely that there's a double reference in this connective. It likely refers to both verse 20, they are without excuse, for, even though they knew God, or it could refer to verse 18, they are truth suppressors, for, even though they knew God. Could refer to either. It likely refers to both. But whether the reference is to one or both of these verses makes little difference for our present point. The point is that both verses 18 and verses 19 and 20 are talking not about a past situation, but a present situation. Note the present tenses of verse 18, is revealed, and who's suppressed. Note the present tenses of verses 19 and 20, is, being understood, are clearly seen. So, the past context is clearly referring to a present situation. That's out of accord with the interpretation of Kuyper and others. But verses 21 through 23 are also tied to the succeeding context. Notice the therefore of verse 24. This passage, verses 24 to 32, is descriptive of a present situation. In verse 31, men are described as God-haters. Now, I think there's some confusion. I think it's verse 31. Maybe I have a wrong reference. Yeah, it is verse 30. And I think it should be verse 30. It may be. I thought it was in the Greek, maybe. Sometimes it's a variation. But anyway, in verse 30, men are described as God-haters. In verse 32, as those who, knowing the ordinance of God, approve evil men. Verse 32 is clearly descriptive of a present situation. So our conclusion must be that men still know God. You see, verses 24 to 32 are descriptive of that very reprobate generation in which Paul and his fellows were living. It's not talking about only a past generation, but a present generation. And verses 21 to 23 are tied to that description by the conjunction, therefore. Our conclusion must be, then, that men still know God. And yet, in another sense, and at the same time, ignorant of it. See the paradox? Their knowledge of God and their ignorance of God coexist. Their knowledge of God is the starting point of their ignorance. This is a paradox. But as I've already tried to point out to you, it is an all-important biblical paradox which must be held in its fullness. Now, a third thing we have to say with regard to this misguided view. The misguided view under discussion might appeal to verses 23, 25, and 28 to support the idea that men have lost their original knowledge of God. We will deal first of all with verses 23 and 25, and then with verse 28. What about verses 23 and 25, which say that they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image? Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. These verses assert that men exchange God and the truth of God for an image and a lie. Does that mean they no longer have the truth in any sense? Well, Raymond responds to this question by saying, they exchanged, not in the sense of giving up, for this would contradict the earlier assertion that they suppressed, but in the sense that they were satisfied to substitute, here's the point, as the immediate object of their worship, the created thing, for the Creator. Their knowledge of the latter they suppressed. In other words, Paul is not talking about their innate knowledge of God. He's talking about their religion. If you went to their temple, what would you find? You wouldn't find the worship of the living God. You'd find an idol. They'd substituted the idol for God. Does that mean they had no awareness or knowledge of God? Of course not. They simply exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. That's all he's saying. As to the object of their worship, they substituted idols for the true God. Note verse 26, for a parallel use of this word where it clearly has the meaning substitute. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions for their women, substituted the natural function for that which is unnatural. Description of lesbianism. They substituted a lie for the truth by means of suppressing the truth. The truth of God in verse 25 is the truth about God. The lie is the false God. In fact, the Greek lexicon supports this meaning of lie, pseudē. Sometimes lie means a false God. But what about verse 28? And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, to have God in knowledge might be a literal translation of the verse. They did not see fit to have God in knowledge, so God gave them over to a depraved mind. It could be asked, doesn't this teach that men are given over to a state of absolute ignorance of God? Well, the answer to that question is no. The word Paul uses here for knowledge always designates practical, religious, and moral knowledge in the noun form. You can consult 1 Timothy 2:4, 2 Timothy 2:25, and 3:7. Notice I said in the noun form. I think the noun in this case is different than the verb. The verb, I think, may designate knowledge in general. It may not be a legitimate distinction between religious or true knowledge, moral knowledge, and general knowledge in the verb. But in the noun, I would be willing to defend the thesis that it always designates religious and moral knowledge. And therefore, it speaks of the saving knowledge of God. The knowledge spoken of in Romans 1:28 is therefore the opposite of mere intellectual knowledge or awareness of God. It is the knowledge which is eternal life. It is theological knowledge. It's natural theology. All right? It's that kind of knowledge we're talking about now in verse 28. So now we have two kinds of knowledges, don't we? Paul says they know God. Now he says they don't have God in knowledge. He's talking about two kinds of knowledge. Men may refuse to know God spiritually and savingly, as Romans 1:28 says, but they cannot cease to know God in the sense of Romans 1:18-21 and 32. All right, any questions about that? Very important section for us to not get derailed by this misinterpretation and some of the things that superficially might seem to support it. All right, the efficient cause of their ignorance. Paul's given us a starting point, they knew God. But now he speaks of its efficient cause. Its efficient cause is stated in the words, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. The cause of their ignorance of God is revealed in the words, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. Men do know God. How is it then, we might ask, that they manifest such amazing intellectual ignorance and mental darkness with respect to the divine truth? If they know God, why are they so ignorant? Why do they live such despicable lives? Did God do something to make them this way? Is this a condition, a result of some divine intervention? Well, the answer to that is no. Of course, verses 24, 26, and 28 speak of a divine judgment, but this judgment falls upon men for and because of this pre-existing state of ethical and intellectual ignorance and wickedness. The ignorance of God is due, according to the passage, in the first place, to a failure to properly respond to the knowledge of God they possess. Their ignorance is their fault. It is a result of their own actions. The root of men's ignorance is moral. It springs from, is caused by ethical rebellion against the demands of what they know. The problem, then, is not with God's revelation. The problem is not, first of all, intellectual. It is that knowing God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks. That's an ethical problem. The problem is not with the mental equipment God has given man. The problem is not with the rationality of God's existence. The problem is not with the evidence. The problem is moral. The rest of the Bible confirms this conclusion by describing atheism as the position of a fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. But a fool in the Bible is not someone who has no knowledge, but one who hates knowledge. Proverbs 1:22, how long, you fools, will you hate knowledge? And so, Paul very carefully specifies that when men are ignorant of God, their present condition of ignorance, their awful ignorance of God, the darkness that they're in, is a result of an ethical problem, a moral deviation. But then we come to the instrumental means of their ignorance. Verse 21c. The means by which they became ignorant of God and suppressed the truth and unrighteousness is stated in the words, they became futile in their speculations. The word translated speculations is a very interesting word. It means thoughts, and therefore clearly designates intellectual activity. However, every occurrence of this word in the New Testament has strongly ethical shades of meaning. It frequently designates intellectual activity controlled by or arising from an evil heart. Earl, Matthew 15:19, and Patrick, Luke 5:22. I want you to see the use of this word in those two passages. First of all, Matthew 15 and verse 19. I want you to begin, I'll begin with verse 17.
Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth comes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and these make the man unclean. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander.
All right. Now the text says, for out of the heart come ekartes kardias. And the first thing that comes out of the heart is the same word used in our text, dialogismo, thoughts. In this case, it's denominated evil thoughts. But you see where thoughts come from? According to this text, thoughts come out of the heart. Thoughts come out of the heart. These thoughts are controlled by an evil ethical disposition. People are thinking out of their hearts. The thoughts come out of the heart. Look at Luke 5. And verse 22. Why don't we begin begin with verse 19, Patrick.
And not finding any way to bring him in because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and let him down through the tiles with his stretcher, right in the center, in the front of Jesus. And seeing their faith, he said, friends, your sins are forgiven you. And the scribes and the Pharisees began to reason, saying, who is this man who speaks blasphemy? Who can forgive sins but God alone? But Jesus, aware of their reasoning, answered and said to them.
Okay. Now, both in verse 21, they reasoned, and in verse 22, their reasonings uses the same word in our text. So who was it that was reasoning, and how were they reasoning? They were scribes and Pharisees, and they were reasoning in a very evil way, you see. Their reasoning was controlled by their rejection of Jesus as the Messiah. And they reasoned in a way that was a result of that presupposition, that heart mindset, if you will. So the word used here in our text, the word speculations, they became futile in their speculations, has a strongly ethical background. In Romans 1:21, it designates intellectual activity arising from men's refusal to honor God. Therefore, I believe it has reference to the intellectual rationalizations of men for this wicked refusal. When a man refuses to honor God, conscience says, "You have an honor to thank God." Heart replies, "I must have had a good reason." So it orders intellect to provide a justification or excuse for sin. That's what's going on here, you see. A man is having to justify himself. He's having to justify his ethical refusal to honor or thank God. And so he puts his intellect to work to do that. And he creates all sorts of philosophies and religions that are simply the sophisticated elaborations of excuses for not honoring or thanking the living God. And Paul adds one to their thought. Such thoughts or reasonings are futile. They are totally fruitless. There can be no intellectual justification for man's ingratitude. Also, all intellectual systems grounded in refusal to ethically honor God can never attain true knowledge. The world, by its wisdom, did not know God, says Paul in 1 Corinthians 3, 18-20. The wise were made foolish. Well, that's the instrumental means of their ignorance, their own intellectual rationalizations. And then fourthly, we come to the resultant condition of their ignorance, verse 21b. And this condition or state is summarized in the words, their foolish heart was darkened. This is the final step in the progression of verse 21. Having given the starting point, efficient cause, and instrumental means of their ignorance, Paul now states the condition which results from this evil moral intellectual process. Their foolish heart was darkened. We've already seen that Paul does not mean to say that they lost or erased their knowledge of God. We have seen that this cannot be Paul's meaning. Rather, the knowledge of God they possess ceases to be a practical, working, conscious principle which can guide their life. It ceases to be for them wisdom. But then in verse 22, Paul deals with the pompous claims of their ignorance. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Did men recognize the darkness they'd gotten themselves into? No. They totally failed to admit or recognize the folly and futility of their intellectual systems. Instead, they proudly claimed the title of wise men. And we must not be upset today by the claims of modern wise men. They've always made such claims. God says in the very making of such claims, they become fools. But then, lastly, sixthly, he deals with the monstrous extent of their ignorance. I'd never noticed before. I have 7, the perfect number for the knowledge of God, and 6, the number of a man for their true suppression. That's amazing how that happened, isn't it? There must be something in it. If I was Harold Camping, I'd get something out of it, I'm sure. Anyway, they substituted idols, says verse 23, for the true God in their religion, going so far as to worship animals and crawling creatures. Paul here informs us that false religions are the height and climax of man's ignorance of God. And exchange the glory. Here's the last end of their departure from God. They exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. This is the last height and climax of man's ignorance of God, their false religion. This is the opposite of the common opinion that the natural man's religions and philosophies are his closest approach to true knowledge of God. Some have viewed natural religions as partial and valid attempts to worship God, needing only to be supplemented by Christianity. Who did that? Justin Martyr. That's right. The following diagram contrasts the view of such people with Paul's view. So, the false view, and a very common view it has been in the history of the church, is that false religions are simply partial and fallible attempts to come to the experiential knowledge of God based upon the innate knowledge of God, the seat of religion, whereas Christianity is the full outworking of that. But you see, the true view, according to the Apostle Paul, begins again with the acknowledgement that both Both false religions and the true religion do assume and presuppose and are rooted in the sanctus deitatis, the semen religionis, the innate knowledge of God, the seed of religion, but that the good and proper development of the seed of religion is in Christianity, which brings men to experiential knowledge of God, but that false religions are an evil and abnormal expression of the seed of religion and result in simply experiential ignorance of God. So that instead of being partial attempts in a good direction, actually every false religion and every false philosophy that is going in exactly the opposite direction from Christianity. Paul views false religions, then, as the worst expressions of human depravity and ignorance. They are emphatically not commendable approaches to God by pitiable men. They are not emphatically not commendable approaches to God in true religion. This means that we are not to measure man's knowledge of God by what he admits to know in his false religions. His false religions are not an admission, they're a distortion. At least in the way he intends them. He knows far more which he is suppressing. In fact, everything he admits is perverted. Otherwise, he wouldn't admit it. Sometimes people have said, now here's how we're going to determine what natural law is. We're going to go out, we're going to kind of survey, we'll see you next, we're going to survey all the different religions in the world, and anything that those false religions or philosophies agree about, or at least most of them agree about, that's what is the true content of natural law. All right? You see how misguided that is? Because all those false religions and philosophies are all of them just the extended, elaborated suppressions of truth. Of course, they may contain, how could they help but contain one or more element of admission of a truth distorted in some way and fit into the system. But you see, they're suppressing and not admitting a lot more that they do know. So you can't do natural law by the democratic survey method. And more than once I've seen men who should know better than that argue that way in their books. Natural law is to be determined by what the Bible says it is, not by what people admit in their false philosophies and false religions, or at least what 95% of them admit. Now, the study must not close without noting the progression of three important steps in this passage. Those three important steps are suppression, verse 18, substitution, verse 23, and reprobation, verse 24. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Then having suppressed the truth, there must be substitution. They exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in their worship. And then that having been done, God responds to that suppression and substitution by reprobation. Verse 24, God gave them over. Now, that's a progression in the passage we have to be aware of. Now, an illustration of this progression may be helpful. The human heart is like a house with a large light in a big bay window in the front room. Even when the new occupants of the house unplug the lamp, they don't like the lamp in the big front window. They don't like its light. It's too bright for them. But even when they unplug it, it keeps shining. Strange light. And then they try to carry it out the door, but it's too big to get out the door. And somehow there's some sort of force field or something there keeping them from taking it out. Okay? So they take it down in the basement. They at least get it down there. The basement, the stairways are large enough to get it down. And it's even shining in the basement. It even kind of glows around the door, and that bothers them too. So they jackhammer the floor, and they bury it beneath the floor of the basement, and they cement it over, and lo and behold, the next day they go down there. Even in the dark, they can see this glow on the floor of the basement. So what do? Well, they take the old black light. I guess those are ultraviolet lamps. They used to be popular when I was a teenager for different purposes. You remember them too, Bob, don't you? And they purchased all these black lights, and they set them up in their basement, and they put a shrine down there, and they put these other lights around, you see? And this disguises the glow on the basement floor. These black lights cast an eerie or ghostly glow in the basement and tend to obscure the glow coming from the basement floor. Well, that's a very... maybe foolish and ridiculous illustration of what's really going on. When men create their false religions, there's nothing good about it. What they're trying to do is to disguise the glow on the basement floors of their hearts. They're trying to disguise their suppression of the truth. It's all an attempt to get rid of something that bothers them. The fact that they have this gnawing, innate awareness of God, they refuse to admit it, but it's there. They need something to disguise it. And what they do is create their false religions to get further away and to further suppress. It's simply, though all those black lights are not in honor of the glow on the floor, it's simply the last attempt at suppression of people who ultimately cannot get rid of the truth. So the glow of their innate knowledge of God must be obscured by the black lights of false religion. Well, that is Paul's, I think, primary statement of their knowledge of God and of theological epistemology. Do you have any questions? Yes, Mike?
On page 114, I started with an actually same question on 118. When you're starting the progression, my question was, when we are in apologetical
confrontation, when talking
against
you,
do we meet men at this first point, or at the point to which they have regressed, or at both?
At both.
So would be both at the same time?
Well, I don't know what you mean by that, but they are both, the point I'm making is that they still know God. They don't admit it. We don't meet them at the first point prior. That depends what you mean, now that I have to back up.
I'm meaning by this point their innate knowledge. Because
they continue
to. They start knowing God, they progress, but all along they still know God.
Mm-hmm. We do meet them at that point.
But then we also meet them where they are denying or suppressing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you can. This is one of the I think most important applications of everything we're saying, that we can preach to men without necessarily addressing all their arguments and engaging in apologetics, because we have all the apologetic we need in one sense in their own hearts. It's not to say that's always wrong, and not even sometimes. Maybe necessary, might be too strong a word, but proper, at least, to address their and to expose the darkness of their false religion, to show them their own inconsistencies, to address all those things. The point that needs to be stressed, though, is that we don't need to do that in order to preach to them and have intellectual justification and right to preach to them. We can address them because they know who they are as sinners, and they know God. So, all of those other things which we might call more properly, specifically or technically apologetics are fine, and they're not wrong, but neither are they crucial prerequisites for presenting them the gospel.
That was when my other question had regard to the end, but plant the same thing. Mm-hmm. You said the natural man's religion and philosophy are the opposite of that. It's as close to the approach to knowledge of God.
In some men, that's true. That in God's working in their life, there is first of all the driving out, gradually becoming dissatisfied with their false views, and that certainly happened in Augustine, as you point out. Manichaeism was dealt with, became very dissatisfying intellectually to him, and that was a way station on the way to his knowledge of God. So I don't think it's wrong to address those things, but I don't think we naturalize those people's experiences. Some men come to that more quickly. But with some, there is a real obstacle in the way that is to say, not to say that it's justifiable, but if But if we're going to get to them and do so in a way that it has the most clout with them, we're going to have to pop the bubble of